Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Castle.
There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river. Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
The minute this podcast is over, I'm getting in the car and driving out to 111th Street. And they have a beer at a place called McNally's. You know about McNally's? McNally's is not a Cubs bar. It's a Sox bar. And it's just, I don't know how to tell you how this feels, but I guess complete and utter relief. I mean, I was even getting texts and calls from, like, the dailies, okay? You know, not my best friends. You know, people are like, oh, my God, let's hope that they don't win. And they didn't win, and that's fine with me. Okay, listen, last year, it was the first one. Cubs won. It was great. You know what I mean? Good for the city, blah, blah, blah. This year, okay, let's just get back to normal. And now the way I see it, the Cubs used to be the underdog team. Guess what? They're now the, like, I don't know, the Lannisters of baseball. They're devouring the entire community. The Taco Bell's gone. The McDonald's is gone. Where the alleys where the coppers used to make extra cash parking cars. All that stuff that was part of the Chicago Way thing at Wrigley. It's becoming corporate town. It is Cubslandia. On the other side of town, now, imagine this. Plucky men in black standing up on their wall on 35th Street guarding the realm. The underdogs in this cultural battle are the White Sox and the White Sox fans. Yeah, we suck, okay? Somebody said, I did a Chuck Garfine's podcast, and he said this was the most exciting 95 loss season we've ever had. And he was mocking himself, which I thought was funny because, you know, look, 95 losses, you suck, basically, okay? But we have a future. And the future is some young ball players, and maybe Jerry's going to let Rick Hahn get some more. But culturally at least, the Sox fans are the underdogs now, the plucky underdogs, the Cubs. They are the great titans of baseball. They eat up whole communities. They eat up the Taco Bell. There's no McDonald's. They just keep growing and growing with their boutique hotel and all this other stuff. Okay, and it is just becoming amazing to see. So, Sox fans, keep your powder dry. Cub fans, I love you, man, but it didn't happen this year. So, you know how my dog Zeus lifts his little paw when he wants a biscuit, and he's sad? When he's sad, he lifts his paw and makes a little whiny sound, and that's what I don't want you to do, Cub fans. Okay, don't do that. This is Chicago. There's no crying in baseball.
That may be very well true, John Cass of the Chicago Way. I'm Jeff Carlin. But you, in your monologue there, you kind of gave us an untruth fact, and I want to make sure we're correct in all our facts.
Yeah, okay. Because you don't want to wear a cowboy hat.
Right, exactly.
And talk about a dead soldier.
Right, okay. Exactly. Yeah. You said the first for the Cubs last year. The first. I appreciate you saying that, but that isn't the first. Cubs and the Sox have both won 3 World Series each, so...
Oh, excuse me. I meant first in this century.
Okay.
I think the Cubs won in 1908 or something, right? Right?
Yep. Okay. Mm-hmm.
I remember interviewing, like, you'd interview old Cub fans.
Right.
Like, and they're kind of dying, you know?
Right.
They're like, they're old.
Like,
they're
like Civil War.
Yeah, they're like...
Veterans or families.
I hope they win, you know, in like 2014, 2000, you know what I mean? And you know they're not gonna. Okay, so the Cubs have won. The Sox have won. The Sox have thrown more World Series victories than the Cubs. One, right?
That's the Chicago way.
That's the Chicago way, doing it for pay. And then poor Shoeless Joe.
Joe Jackson, yeah.
Although Shoeless Joe now seems to go with Joe Berrios for some reason. I want to call Joe Berrios Shoeless Joe. All right, so how did you deal with it? Were you sad? I know you care more about the Hawks than you
right.
do the Cubs.
I was more sad by the way the Hawks lost in overtime when the same night the Cubs lost, because they were playing very hard, and Connor McDavid is the
But isn't there a comparison between the Hawks win the Stanley Cup a couple years ago,
right? First time in 49 years,
and then when they win it. The year they didn't repeat. They played a lot of extra games. They were tired. They came back and they lost some of their core, some of their not the flashy stars,
right.
But the diggers.
Yeah,
and
the
same
gamers.
Thing, right? And it looks like the Cubs ran into that same problem.
Absolutely, no, absolutely. They were fun to watch, and you saw there were spots where they got cold and they just couldn't do anything to come out of it. And you know, really good teams who switch up the lineup, bring up some of the gamers. Let them get hot and at least give you a different taste, and then your team bounces back. Cubs really didn't have that this year. They didn't have a Dexter Fowler they could lean on at leadoff, or even Kyle Schwarber. I mean, they had him in the whole season. They didn't
I
have
don't
him,
want him.
Didn't have him.
You guys are
going to
deal.
I know.
You're
well,
going to get rid of him. I don't want him. I don't want him on the Sox.
No, you want him. Why
no,
not?
I don't. No, I don't.
Why?
No, I don't.
Why not?
I don't want him.
Why?
I don't want another guy who can't do anything but. Bet left-handed,
but that's what you need.
No. I don't want him.
You
didn't. I don't want him. I don't want him.
DH, you're giving up. If he DH'd on the south side,
oh, how about if I trade you
60 home runs?
Okay, what if I trade you? Here's the typical Cub fan thing, the way they do. Also, you want to take Schwarber, and you'll just take back those prospects that we gave for Quintana, right?
No, see, this past year I wanted Quintana for Schwarber straight up. I thought it would have been a perfect trade, and you guys would have had somebody who would have been a DH for the next 15 years.
No, thank you.
Hitting 50 home runs a season.
Oh, now it's 50. It was 60 10 seconds ago.
I'm saying for the course of 15 years, he'll average 50 home runs. Uh-huh. But he's in his prime, so he'll hit 60 next year.
Schwarbs, good player, should be playing first. How about this? You guys trade Rizzo for prospects.
He doesn't have the...
And put Schwarbs at first.
No, you can't do that.
Why not?
Because you give up...
yes, you can.
No, you give up a batting average and a glove at first for...
For prospects and pitching, because that's what you need. You want to be in it?
We've got cash and prospects. We can deal and squeal. We can get a million Quintanas.
We have nothing. All we have is
Former
the wall...
Cubs.
We have the wall. We have the Sox fans are like the Wildings and the Night's Watch combined. We're like the last best hope of the realm.
There's some royalty in there.
There's
but
some,
know,
but
yeah.
discredited, you right. know. Guys like me kind of like thrown off to the side.
Exactly.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
But you guys with all your...
It's joie de vie?
I wouldn't say joie de vie. I would say more like this is the team that had Donald Trump sing at the... national anthem.
Which he did not do very well. It was a seventh inning stretch, and it was not very good.
But he didn't do it at. He didn't sing at Comiskey at the Sox.
Well, it's because about Trump. It's all about ratings, and that's why would he go.
Speaking of which, politics is politics, right?
Yeah.
Should we talk about politics?
Sure. It's going to be a busy week.
I have to say, you're not often blown away by. A news conference when political people are involved. I've gone past that in my life. You know, I'm like, people are like, oh, do you really like this politician or that? And I'm, no. You know, it's like asking Paulie Sullivan, which ball player do you like? He knows the inside and out of that. I know the inside and out of politics, at least to some extent. I'm not an expert completely, but I'm not surprised when they do stuff. But I'll tell you this. What General Kelly did last week by standing up and excoriating that ridiculous, disgusting congressman, woman with the hat, that stupid hat, the false eyelashes, the bad hair, just that whole creepy attitude of hers.
Frederica Wilson.
Frederica Wilson making a political issue out of the death of a soldier and trying to blame Trump. And on the other hand, I got to say, Trump should never have responded as he did to begin it. He began it.
And
right?
Kelly made that point when he spoke in front of the press briefing on that the Thursday, And he mentioned, he said, you know, just the sickness and the disgust that he even had to be there to talk about this. And he was there and had to say, I mean, because he came out and made a statement. And then he said, okay, I'm going to take a couple questions from the press, but I got to run. You know, I'm a busy guy. I got stuff to do. And he says, but I only want to talk about, and then he paused and he said, well, you know, I only want to talk about this phone call situation because, and I can't believe I have to do that because this is ridiculous. And he went on to excoriate Representative Wilson for just getting involved and be listening on a phone call that she shouldn't have been and taking away a piece of what the president said.
The dignity of the moment, mm-hmm. regardless of whether you like the president or
right.
not. But President Trump opened himself up for this by talking about how he called more people who died, the families who died, the casualties, than did Obama or Bush. He made stuff up in his mind or someone told him something and he went
right. on. Somebody once told him that they didn't get a phone call from Obama and it might have been Kelly.
It's pathetic.
And so Trump said, I didn't. Most presidents don't do this. And
he just adds to stuff.
Right. It's that braggadociousness. And I was thinking about this the other day, and this is what I always do when I produce, is you see these stories, you see the tweets. The tweets drive me nuts because every tweet the president throws out there, you have to weigh in your head. Is this big enough of something, information, or a change in dynamic of the story or whatever's happening there? Or should I jump on it and should we make, you know, hay out of just nothing? Because sometimes he says stuff and you're just like, okay, it's just him tweeting. It's ridiculous.
Ignore it, right?
Ignore it. There's no point in getting
all
tied up in it.
Well, you can't ignore this. I'll give you something mm-hmm. here. So Kelly made his statement. Mm-hmm. He talked about walking, you know, with all this the politics and the disgusting politics of this congressperson. He talked about going out to Arlington Cemetery, walking through the graves of the finest people that he knew, right? People, he said, that he put there, some of them, right? And so after he's done, the left freaked out. Okay, we've already established Trump never should have gotten into a competition, which was stupid,
a competition
about who
cares
more.
Widows or loved
ones. Yeah, it's ridiculous, but typical of him. But Kelly stood up because he was talking about the issue, the other issue, which was, I think, more important than your partisan politics. And what happened? The left went nuts. I'll read you something. From Brian Fallon of CNN, former spokesman for Hillary Clinton. And he said, okay, that's perfect, right? Because that's what happens when you're a political hack, you end up on CNN, okay? So, or Fox or whatever. So, Fallon says, Kelly isn't just an enabler of Trump. He's a believer. That makes him as odious as the rest. Don't be distracted by the uniform. And Tom Bevin responded.
Friend of the show.
Friend of the show, our buddy Tom. He quoted him, don't be distracted by the uniform, WTF. Because he wasn't wearing a uniform.
Right.
And because his son died in Afghanistan. Now, where is it? Why, you know, it just amazes me, Jeff, that Trump can say stupid stuff, right? Like, mm-hmm. oh, I care more about dead soldiers than did Obama.
Right.
Okay?
Or stupid. Any other president, too.
Whatever, stupid yeah. stuff. But then the left goes absolutely insane to the point where anytime you, from now on, if this Brian Fallon says anything, he's a piece of crap. He's a moron to say something like that about Kelly. So why is it that the left overreacts to stimuli in such a way that they completely disrespect themselves and their place in the debate?
Yeah, I don't even think it's so much to the fact that it makes him into an idiot or a fool or whatever. I mean, we talked about this before. It's jestering. I mean, he's a jester. There is a deep pocket and a deep river of jesters in media on both sides. I mean, you've got your types like Judge Napolitano on Fox.
Yeah.
He's one of the type of who knows the reality of situations. He's a very smart guy, very well, great understanding of the law. And when you get him to talk about legal stories, he's incredibly insightful, and you get so much from him. But
as opposed to Jeanine Pirro?
Well, no. I like Jeanine, too. She's a friend. I like her. But she's guilty of this, too. She gets paid to bring certain essence to a
buzzwords,
conversation.
Yeah. Buzzwords.
So when she's in conversation and it has nothing to do with the legal piece of it or it's fringely attached to a legal story, and she's just commentating or he's just commentating, they're out there to push the meter and push the buttons and get people to react. Same thing on the left. You guys, the Fallon comes from the same type of background that a lot of the CNN commentators, but also a lot of the Fox commentators come from. They come from these political backgrounds. They wouldn't have a name. No one would want to put them on TV if they weren't who they were and didn't come from where they did. And they're jesters to that extent. They move the story. They try to push people to come back in listenership and viewership. And I think you give them too much credit. They shouldn't be giving any credit to take away. You call them a fool and a piece of crap. But I think he's.
But to say that about Cal, I don't care if you're on the left or the right. You say that about a general who's one of the few mm-hmm. of the elites in Washington whose child actually wore the uniform and died.
Right.
I don't think there was any of them.
I know.
All the neocons who've been pushing the war, all the other ones who virtue signal. No. And he wasn't virtue signaling.
No.
He was talking about something that was lost, something that's been lost. Like a decency,
mm-hmm.
a common understanding of decency, where a congresswoman doesn't listen in to the conversation between the president and the wife of the widow of the fallen.
Mm-hmm.
And I find the whole thing to be, but I think your point about gesturing,
yeah.
Thanks, because yes, right? Jesters, and they dance with their little curly-toed boots, and they have bells on their hats, and... just a few days ago, there was an interesting... I don't watch Fox News except for Tucker Carlson. And I was listening to him talk to one of the guys I like, who's on the far left, Greenwald. The Glenn Greenwald. And Greenwald was talking about how the left, the sort of hive mentality of left journalism is... And he's of that. Is basically bringing them into a bad place, a terrible place, because they are completely lost. They have kind of they're hurting themselves in circles.
So you and I don't agree on a lot of issues, but I think we share the same concern about this story, and that is that American journalists are being manipulated for whatever reason by the intelligence community in the United States. And I'm wondering why, after years of having this happen to American journalists, they're allowing this to happen again.
Well, that's the thing. I would reframe that a little bit. I don't actually think so much that journalists are the victims in the sense of that formulation, that they're being manipulated. I think, at best, what you can say for them is they're willingly and eagerly being manipulated. because what you see is, over and over, they publish really inflammatory stories that turn out to be totally false. And what happens in those cases? Nothing. They get enormous benefits when they publish recklessly. They get applause on social media from their peers. They get zillions of retweets, huge amounts of traffic. They end up on TV. They get applauded across the spectrum because people are so giddy and eager to hear more about this Russia and Trump story. And when their stories get completely debunked, it just kind of everybody agrees to ignore it, and everyone moves on and they pay no price. At the same time, they're feeding and pleasing their sources by publishing these stories that their sources want them to publish. And so there's huge amounts of career benefits and reputational benefits and very little cost when they publish stories that end up being debunked because the narrative they're serving is a popular one, at least within their peer circles.
Human sacrifice, dogs and cats living together, mass hysteria.
Joining us now is my friend and Sox fan and political consultant and just general overall genius himself, Thomas Serafin from Serafin and Associates. Tom, when you woke up after the Cubs lost, how did you feel?
They fought tough all year long. I'm a White Sox fan, and I was hoping Quintana would pitch a great game and take him back to California. But Quintana came over from the White Sox trade. The Yankees got two or three of our ball players, and they're going to be playing this weekend to be in the World Series. So the White Sox ballplayers are doing well. I felt badly for Quintana, although he went 7-3 with the Cubs. So the Cubs got a good ball player there.
Political on your part. On my part, I lifted a beer and screamed out loud and said, because I was so happy. But you know what? I didn't call you for your baseball acumen. I called you for your political acumen.
Theo Epstein. You know Theo Epstein put the Cubs together.
Yeah.
His first selection for manager for the Cubs was a guy by the name of Renteria. And when Joe Madden came along, he dropped Renteria. Yeah. But Renteria is the White Sox coach. You know, bilingual. He communicates with the ball players. He's got a good team. We're going to be very competitive next year. I think the Cubs are going to be competitive again. But, you know, it's going to be a good couple more years ahead of us in baseball in this town on both sides.
Right now, though, we don't really think about baseball because it's over,
yes.
Happily, so we don't have to go through that whole tortured process. But Tom and I did attend a gubernatorial. Why do they call it that, Jeff Carlin? Gubernatorial forum.
The goobers
of the Democrats out in I don't know where we're in the northwest suburbs, right, Tom?
Mount Prospect. The Daily Herald put it on, it was in Mount Prospect, Illinois. At Victory, I think it was Victory Gardens. I'm not sure, but a nice place out there.
It was a beautiful room, but for proms and weddings. But for politicians, I thought there was a star to me. Of all of them, I thought Chris Kennedy on the Democratic side seems to be doing quite well in terms of how he's addressing issues of Democratic concern like Mike Madigan and corruption on that side, and also the need to purge the party of that while seeking, you know, how can you ask people for tax increases if you don't get rid of your own corruption? I find Kennedy to be the most interesting candidate of all, probably the one that Rauner would have least liked to have faced before, you know, Rauner shot his foot off with the burnt toast move on the abortion bill, taxpayer-funded abortion. What did you think of the Democratic candidates, Tom?
I was, it was the first time I've seen them all on stage before, and there were five or six or seven of them. And of course, you have J.B. Pritzker and Kennedy, who are in the most recent polls that you see published over the last week, the electronic polls that weren't really testing Democratic voters. And there's a Democratic primary; they have to survive yet before they see the governor. But in general election numbers, you know, registered voters, Pritzker is allegedly ahead 39-15. But Kennedy has been the closest of all the Democrats to criticize current chairman of the Democratic Party, Mike Madigan, and the way the party works and the way the party doesn't work. He's been the most critical of that organization and leadership. Others have kind of sidestepped that issue because Mr. Madigan is the boss and has been since 1980-81. So, I mean, he's in charge. And, he can help you get elected or he can help you be defeated. And without his support statewide, it's rare, very rare, that you can get elected to public office. So
I don't know. With Kennedy, though, I got a feeling Kennedy will pull in African-American voters on the Democratic side. I don't think Pritzker is going to do that. He's going to have to spend a lot of money to get African-American Democrats. I just think I don't see the connection there. Also, I was looking at him, and we were talking during breakfast, a very fine breakfast that it was with the good sausages and so forth.
Actually, it was one of the better breakfasts on the circuit so far this year.
But I thought that Pritzker, you said, look at Pritzker up there. Remember we were having breakfast. You go, look at Pritzker up there. He just seems so confident, so satisfied.
Well, he should be. He's racked up a lot of big labor. He's racked up a lot of big Democrats. He's got a lot of people following his campaign. He's got, he spent $1.5 million. That was it was just one of the newspaper articles the other day. $1.5 million on staff, which way out forces any of his opponents right now. He's got half a dozen or more offices. I think he's got 8-9 offices around the state. Unheard of, for a Democratic candidate for governor, helping rebuild the party, remembering, of course, that Bruce Rauner won every county downstate outside of Cook County. It's a red state, has been for the last few years, gubernatorial-wise. So he's going to have to do a lot of work down there. And if he does that and does that successfully, he's formidable. I mean, he's very formidable. In the city, Kennedy, as you say, in the minority community, he's got a strong foothold. Although, Pritzker's done a real good job spending a lot of money. I mean, he spent $21 million in the campaign through the end of September. And a lot of it on television, a lot of it up here, a lot of it downstate.
Precinct money out there. A lot of walking around money from Pritzker. Yeah. I see Pritzker walk down the street, and I think of all the Democratic bosses running after him, trying to pick up crumbs in his wake, you know? Like, thanks, Mr. Pritzker. Thank you. Yeah, we'll get the vote out. You know, I need a couple grand to just tell the boys to get, you know, for coffee for the boys, that kind of thing.
Right. I mean, he's certainly capable of laying a golden egg, you know, in places where people are supportive of him and where he can spend a few days. So, I mean, yes. That all, money always helps. It's going to be the largest and the most expensive campaign in the country this year. Certainly the most expensive ever here in Illinois. It's going to exceed $300 million. I think the last big race for governor was California for $280 million. So, I mean, this is going to be the most costly campaign ever. And Bruce Rauner is trying to attack towards the left. And, again, all the Democrats are trying to push him towards, you know, Trump. So, you know.
But that doesn't work. I mean, he's not a Trump guy. Never liked Trump, and just comes off as disingenuous. They might as well wear cowboy hats like that Florida congressman woman.
What I was surprised about the Democrats is that there was a lot to go around to criticize and to talk about with Trump and Bruce Rauner, and they all talked about it. But you know, Bruce Rauner has only been governor for 3 years, and our problems in Illinois go back 50, 60 years ago. These are problems that have been ignored for a long time, and now you can no longer kick the can down the road. So, I mean, there's issues where you have to look internally. The Democrats all talked about, you know, we have to do this, we have to do that, you know, we have to raise some revenue here, we have to do things over here. But nobody ever talked about a systematic way of cutting the budget or taking a hard look at it. You know, Dan Walker got elected over Paul Simon, you know, a long time ago in the primary, then in the general election, I think it was Ogilvy. But he talked about zero-based budgeting. At least he had a concept. He was only in a one-termer, getting in trouble with Daley at the time, and he lost in the primary. But in this particular case, there's no effort by the Democrats, or at least there's no obvious effort right now. There's no coordinated effort to take a hard look at the budget and see where we can cut. All of us, the middle class is disappearing in Illinois. People are leaving the state. We have crime issues. The state of Illinois and the city of Chicago are near bankruptcy, although they can't necessarily declare it that way. But where are we cutting? You know, where are we cutting? What's the big picture? How are we going to do this? All those specifics are not on the table, nor have they been discussed. And so I think, guys, it's still warming up. It's still, you know, spring, as the spring game. So, if you're playing baseball, it's still February, March for most of the candidates right now.
Hey, Tom, and speaking of that, do you think these forum-type pieces are really impactful at all? I mean, from a communication standpoint, I feel like it really just gives us, you know, the media types, to fodder to throw around and kind of lay out storylines. But do they really impact voters, do you think? Do people get an impression that they feel like they know these guys because they're out here in a forum together, or they see something?
Well, it gives those candidates an opportunity to take those times when they're up on a stage somewhere and then repodcast that, reprogram that, put it on various different platforms and publish it themselves. It gives them an opportunity to really push it and push their sound bites to a variety of audiences. So it actually helps candidates today more than it does the media. You get a chance to see what's going on, but you know, when people are going passing over the media right to the voters, it makes it difficult. So the more the forums, the better, actually, from your vantage point, and the more practice these people get. I think it's Bob Dauber from Edwardsville, Illinois, you know,
educator and farmer.
Yes. I thought, you know, he came across strong. I mean, obviously he needs to know more about how Springfield operates, but he certainly came at it from a point of view where, you know, in a debate where you have one or two other people and he could talk about education, it would force people to take a hard look at some of the cost-cutting measures they used in Edwardsville and how you go forward. I mean, you have to have somebody there that's going to force the issue and ask people the tough questions, and that won't happen until you go face-to-face in probably February, right down the stretch into the March primary.
In my mind, there's only two candidates who have a chance of winning the primary, Pritzker and Kennedy. The other ones, good people, but in reality, there's a price to get out. You know, Biss thinks, State Senator Dan Biss, he thinks he's going to have a future. He looks like a guy who thinks he's going to have a future in politics. He's all thin and cool looking, and I was a, you know, math teacher, but really I'm a, you know, he's all that has the logic and all that. He's pushing his progressive end, but against Kennedy, that kind of fails. So He's got to have a price. T.O.'s got to have a price. When do they get out, and what do they get for getting out and endorsing what, either Pritzker or Kennedy? Because to me, that's the deal.
There's a host of things that you can negotiate and you can talk about. And obviously, you know, I think after, you know, Kennedy gets up on the air and starts competing with J.B. Pritzker's millions of dollars over the airwaves, and, you know, he's got some pretty sharp people working for him when it comes to social media and the internet. So I think he'll be competitive when it comes February and March. And when you see the numbers getting more and more competitive, whether it's January, February, March, that's when the race closes and people start negotiating and saying, hey, what do you need to be in this race for? You've got 6% of the vote. You get the progressive wing of the party. I need those people. Those are usually workers. Why don't you, you know, come in with me and, you know, we'll see what we can do on your legislation. What's your platform? What do you want to see? You know, you want to see more money in education? I'll work with you on these. I mean, there's a lot of ways to go about it and do it. But those conversations are ongoing. I remember a race I was involved with in 84, and I tried to, we were running out of money and we were doing well, but, you know, I went over to the other side and said, hey, we probably would entertain an opportunity if we could, you know, get some of our issues and platform married, where we would probably, you know, could be supportive of you, because we're going to run out of money eventually, and I think we could be of assistance. Some people said no. Other people said, well, think about it, but nobody called me back. So, you know, the timing is everything, and in this particular race, if JB finds himself 30 points ahead of everybody else, you know, in the first part of March, it's a bad time to negotiate because he doesn't need to negotiate with anybody. If it's a dead heat, you know, it'd be nice to pick up, you know, 5-6% of the vote from a candidate who's willing to throw in with you, as long as those issues are and you can agree on things. But nowadays, you know, anything beyond those agreements, you know, those handshakes, you got to trust the person you're working with. Nothing's going to be in writing.
And Tom, speak about that. Someone who's been doing this and been on the ground in campaigning here in this state for so long, how has the game changed? I mean, I see the money obviously is the biggest change. Everyone sees that. But I mean, what do you see that's different now than it was, say, 20 years ago, 30 years ago even?
Well, the money enables you. Well, forget about it. If you had no money, you have so many more platforms today. In the old days, you had in Illinois, you had, you know, a hard group of, you know, less than 48 people that controlled all access to all media and all audiences and all network television newscasts, all local newscasts, all newspapers, editorial boards. I mean, it was a very small group of people. And if you weren't able to convince one, two, or three, or four, or five of the important leaders in that group, you weren't going to get a lot of exposure. Today, there are 480,000 platforms and blogs and opportunities to move your messages and get into the various different tribes. And if you get into certain philosophical or political tribes who are activated, you know, and you can convince them of your issues, you have a real army to work with. So the opportunity of the internet, what it gives you is somebody not with a lot of money, but with a lot of knowledge and with a lot of, you know, willingness to work hard at night and to work around the clock and understand the shift work now that you have to do in the world of communications. If you do that well, you can have some success. But in a situation like Illinois, and John's right, I mean, unfortunately, the top two guns are going to be the two guns he just mentioned. It's going to be a $200 million maybe primary. I mean, it's going to be $200-$300, you know, general election. The numbers are extraordinary, and the money you can't compete with, and you can go right to the voter, and you can get right into the bedroom of the voter. If you have Pandora on your telephone and you're listening to some music on the bus going home, J.B. Pritzker comes on every half hour and talks to you about what he's doing. I mean, there's certain places that you would never hear a political message before. Now they can penetrate anywhere. And, you know, you're writing a press release, or you're writing something at work, and all of a sudden a pop-up comes up, and it could be J.B. or Kennedy or someone saying, you know, I understand you saw the newspaper this morning, you read this article for more than 30 seconds, and this is the issue that they can pinpoint your attitudes on certain days. I mean, the science of this business of communications is really fascinating and really getting very, very specific, and that's the exciting part in my industry. But in the world of politics, it bypasses a lot of filters. It leaves it up to the voter to make up their own mind. Uneducated or educated, unfortunately.
And you're seeing people now calling kind of for controls in that situation because social media had such a big role in the previous presidential election. I mean, there was a study done by MIT about the connectivity between Twitter users who voted for Hillary, who would have voted for Bernie or Trump, and even other Republicans. And the group that would have voted for Hillary and other Republicans, they're interwoven between different journalist groups and different think tanks, and there's a big web of users. But out in the way away from them, not connected in any way, was this group of Trump voters. And they were not impacted at all by mainstream media, but they were thoroughly impacted by grassroots, quote-unquote, media from Trump's campaign being able to, like you said, activate those tribes. And they pushed his message so heavy in places like Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. And you saw this groundswell. We were like, well, where did all these people come from? Well, that's where they came from. They were reached right by the campaign itself. And it's such an amazing time where you can pick one person on the street specifically and get them a message one way or another based on how they use the internet. And it's also creepy because that's how the Russians got involved. But it's got to be, like you said, so different from what it was a few years ago.
You know, the real smart operators today have, you know, they go out and they promote and they use the internet and they use the science and the opportunity to access and move messages, you know, on a 24-hour clock. It's not an 8-hour clock, 24/7. I mean, constantly moving, and you can't really manage a 24-hour clock unless you're managing it. So people usually go to sleep, but people are working shifts nowadays, and they're moving these informations and these messages on in a consistent, logical, every hour basis. And if you're not up to that, it's real hard to compete. It's real hard to be competitive. And if you have the resources behind it to do it, you're bypassing a lot of the traditional sources. So information becomes what it is when it is information. That's the danger, just like history. If students of history are not doomed to repeat it, but we don't have students, you know, of politics, we don't have students of government, we don't have students of the history of government, and we don't have students and knowledgeable of what issues are all about, what the tax code is all about. We don't have people that actually understand current events. We don't have people who understand who the representative is. And so their impact is so easily, viscerally, through these mediums, and those people then are activated. And they can make a difference. And, you know, you can argue about what side they were on in the last presidential election. But there's a whole group of voters out there that are neglected and ignored. And when you capture them, you can move them rather easily because, unfortunately, they're not well educated to the system and to their own government.
I grew up, as some of you know, not too far from the Union Stockyards. And Mr. Brannigan was one of the great softball players of Chicago. Mr. Brannigan, I remember him. He was a cattle buyer, and he moved out to Oak Lawn with a lot of us when we, you know, left the city. Mr. Brannigan, they called him Moon. They would herd the cattle through the chutes, right? Sometimes they used like little prods to do it. Prods, mm-hmm. Like they'd stick a pig or something with little, you know what I mean? Now they have electric stuff they stick pigs with, and this pig goes in the chute. And that electric stuff, whether it's a cattle prod or your phone, okay, is about herding you. And the more and more that this new medium comes up and people say stuff and you don't know who they are. You don't know what their credibility is. You don't know what their background is. They change names. They have like cartoon faces. They say stuff with cartoon heads and people retweet it. I just find this extremely fascinating. It's either the information age or the end of information. I don't know which time.
Well, we spend a significant amount of time, obviously, promoting our messaging and others in my company for our clients. But also, a significant amount of effort goes into cleansing reputations and brands and information. That's also a consistent piece of the business today that never existed years ago. That was never a necessary piece. Today, that's a constant necessary piece of the armaments. If you're in the communications business, you have to have a cleansing operation as well as an operation where you promote your messaging and your branding and reputation for clients. But you also now need to cleanse and repair and
you do that. How do you do that? I've got people writing, saying stuff on the internet that I never said. Like people saying, this one guy on the left, some total lefty that I used to like till he went nuts, said, something like Cass is a scab. He admitted that he's a scab. I never admit. I don't know what he's talking about, but it's out there now. Right? So people react to it. How do you cleanse that stuff, Tom Sturfin? Do I have to, you know, use a Brillo pad? What do I do?
Well, you kind of have to use a Brillo pad, and you know, Brillo pad works when you use elbow grease. You can't just put a Brillo pad on something and get those rust spots off that iron skillet I use. You got to use some elbow grease. So the same thing in this business of communications. You have to use some elbow grease. You have to get in there and do the long, hard, dirty work of going, you know, house to house, you know, file to file, comment to comment. And you have to have a authenticated third party. You need authentication, and you get that through either a legitimate resource source or, you know, third party. It depends on the issue, the client, and the problem. But you if you don't do that, it lives forever. The library of all of our lives today is the internet. And so when you push your name in there in Google, everything up there is the library on your life.
Good.
Some of those books could be badly written by the neighbors that didn't like you. You got to take those books out, take them off the shelf, and throw them out of the library.
One that has been thrown out years ago when Jeff and I were doing this at another new radio station, Jeff found a quote from President Obama in Philadelphia where he was saying on the internet. He was saying it in his own words. He was doing the Chicago way, which is why I liked it, because Obama even said it. Try to find Obama saying he picks a knife, you get a gun. Try to find him saying that now in Philadelphia. You might not find it, because I've been looking all over for it. It's just impossible. And that's one of the things that they do, right? You clean it up. You purge. You
right.
scrub, right? So
right,
it's almost like, he didn't say it. Of course he said it. I remember he said it. Right? In Philadelphia, in the campaign.
Right, it was that Tarantino movie, that character, Mr. Cleanup, was Harvey Keitel, remember? That?
Mr. Wolf, yeah.
Mr. Wolf, sure, yes, that's all part of the science of the business today. You need to do that, and some people do it very, very, very well. Yeah, and it costs money, obviously, because it takes time and energy and research and people on the keyboards, but it's part of the process of doing business in today's world.
A fascinating discussion about cleaning up information and reputation and name with one of the best in the business, Tom Sturfin of Sturfin & Associates. Tom, I want to thank you very much for being here with us today. And by the time people will have read this or seen this, you and I and Annie and Betty and a couple other people will have had a nice lunch or dinner at Stacy's. So I can't wait to see it.
Okay.
All right, my friend.
All right, God bless you guys. Thank you, Dylan.
Well, that was Tom Sturfin, and this is John Cass of the Chicago Tribune, and Jeff Carlin, producer of WGN Radio. He produces the Rokan and Anna show. One thing I'd like to tell you, remember, there's no crying in baseball. The Sox are the underdogs now, and we like it that way. The Fire are going to be in the playoffs, and all politicians lie. You know how you know that? Because you've already been on the Chicago way.